Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Sub-agendas piled on top of each other to the space of connecting with more of an agendaless interaction. I'm curious to see how you view these two as distinct and what your sort of experience has been across both modes of connecting.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, thank you, Raul. I'm really excited to be in conversation with Ulrika about these subjects. As you said, I've been involved in the public policy and political world for most of my career. And I think, you know, obviously networking and the value of relationships are very, very powerful in that world. But, you know, they often do come with at least a sense, if not agenda, of a kind of purpose or transaction, like a sense of looking to people for the various assets they can offer and interacting in that way for purposes of a common, you know, maybe a common agenda. What I found so beautiful about my journey in service space is really starting to embrace this notion of just holding space for people in a completely agendaless way, engaging in deep listening, engaging in just trying to connect to people at a deeper core level that transcends maybe the small I or the ego and the sense of impact in the world, and just let the commonalities and the kind of connections emerge and something even potentially more beautiful than what our brain could drive as an agenda, let that potentially emerge. So I'm very much in that transition from, you know, kind of traditional mainstream networking to agendaless interactions. So I'm excited to hear about Ulrika, to hear about her story, and she's been so much on the cusp of a lot of these kinds of issues all her life. So with that, it's my pleasure to welcome Ulrika Reinhardt as our guest this week.
Yeah, thanks a lot, and hello to everyone out there.
Yeah, so just a brief summary. Ulrika is a German publisher, author, futurist, and she's been involved in a lot of global development efforts throughout her lifetime. Currently, she lives mostly in India, in rural India, where she is the woman behind a skateboard park that in a village that is, and that park is upending notions of caste and gender and empowering a community economically. She's been also involved in development efforts in West Africa. And I think interestingly about Ulrika, beyond this, is she has been so involved in kind of the whole advent of collective intelligence and networks and decentralized and distributed power long before the internet arose. She herself is a connector, an enabler of people. She's traveled to, you know, hundreds of countries interviewing Nobel laureates, politicians, thinkers, entrepreneurs, and has published a lot of these interviews on her YouTube channel and in various magazines. So she's someone who's very astutely aware of the power of connections, and especially genuine connections. So with that, welcome, Ulrika, and we look forward to hearing more about you, and I'll kick it off with that. Yeah.
Thank you very much for this introduction. Yeah, I'm happy no one can see my red, flushed face now.
Wonderful. Yeah. So I thought maybe if we can start just a little bit with, you can tell us, you know, your current efforts, and then we can work back from there. Right now, you live mostly in rural India, working on the skateboard park. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you're doing now, how long you've been doing it, and why skateboards?
Yeah, so I arrived in India more or less by coincidence 5.5 years ago, and somehow I got stuck. And, you know, people say either you love India or you hate it. For me, it's turned out to be a love relationship, but once in a while, yes, I do hate it. I started out to work in Madhya Pradesh, which is the heart of India. It's a very laid-back area, you know, a lot of unemployment. Most of the people living in these villages, they are holding below the poverty line cards, meaning they make for their families less than $1.30 a day. And the families are very often, you know, quite big. They have 8-10 mouths to feed. So it's a very poor area. The village I am in, Chandbar, is 1,300 people are living there, probably 150 houses. There is no sanitation. There is no electricity. There is no shop in the village. There is no public transportation. So they really have to walk like 4 kilometers to the main road to catch a bus or get any kind of connectivity. And then just imagine in the middle of this village where you have mud houses, not really paved roads, there we have built a skate park 3 years ago. And it's the biggest skate park in India. It's like close to 500 square meters. I don't know how many square feet this is. And it's really, it's for many people who are coming there, it's surreal to see this. An open place where in the middle the skate park is around all these houses and the villages. And it's a very, very open space. It's something which the people there have never ever experienced before. Usually when you build something, the first thing you build, it's a huge fence and the gate, and you know, you set up like 5 signs. This is private property, please do not enter. We have done the complete opposite. We have built the skate park with the help of skateboarders from all around the world. It was, the money came from a crowdfunding action I did. I did an auction on eBay. And we were auctioning skateboards, which were transformed into art boards from artists around the world. We auctioned them, and with this money, I built a skate park. So again, this was a community effort. Then the skateboarders came in, and with the help of the local people, within 3.5 months, we set up the skate park. And then in April 2015, so to speak, was the grand opening. And the grand opening was only that I handed over 15 skateboards and 15 set of safety gears and helmets to the kids. And I told them, it's yours. With it, whatever you do. I'm not a skateboarder, but I've seen that skateboarding has quite a transformative power. I've seen this in Afghanistan with a Skatistan project like 10 or 12 years ago. An NGO was setting up a little bit outside of Kabul, a skate park very closely attached to a school. And I've been there a couple of times and I saw what happened to the girls participating in skateboarding there. I mean, you see girls completely wheeled, but they are pretty safe and sound on these skateboards. It really gave them a lot of self-confidence, and it made them aware that they are capable of doing something. So this was actually my inspiration to, you know, set up this surreal place in Chandbar and use skateboarding, which is quite, I would say, it's quite sexy to look at. You know, it's a very, very attractive sport. You need mental but also physical balance. It's, you know, it's a sport for an individual, but you need certain social skills as well to behave in this given set of cement where they skateboard. So yeah, there are many reasons why it is skateboarding and not cricket or soccer or basketball, what I used to play when I was young. Yeah.
So I'm curious.
It's a pretty long answer.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. You mentioned that you came to India about, I think you said 5.5 years ago or so. Did you come with the intention of setting up a skateboard park or, you know, or trying to engage in development efforts? And I guess the question I have is, why India and why Madhya Pradesh?
Yeah, no, there was no plan. There was seriously no plan. I came to India, and this was really for the very first time, this 5.5 years ago, because I was invited to a conference. So I booked my ticket. I flew into Delhi, where the conference took place. And I thought, you know, I would fly out of Bombay, because I've never been to India, and I somehow, you know, wanted to go from Delhi to Bombay. So when the conference was over, I started to look at the map and find my way to Bombay. So first thing I did, I went to see the Taj Mahal. I always wanted to see this since I was a teenage girl. And then the next stop was actually Khajuraho, these world famous temples. It's actually, I think it's World Heritage Site there. So I went to see these temples. And this is Madhya Pradesh. And I stayed there at a private hotel, and somehow I got into conversation with the owners. And they said, you know, we were always planning to build a school somewhere, and maybe you can do this with us. I said, you know, why me, and why are you offering me this after, you know, only 2 days staying there? I stayed a couple of days longer. We talked, and somehow this idea of doing something in India, in this area, was, you know, it somehow I saved it on my hard drive up there in my head. And I went out from Bombay, and at Bombay Airport, I received an email from a friend, and he was writing, you know, whenever on your travels, when you have work for me to do, I would have to join you. So I simply answered, you know, why don't you come to India and build a school? It was more or less a joke, and he answered yes. So 4 weeks later, both of us went back to Madhya Pradesh to explore with this family what we can do and how we could do it. So we stayed another 4 or 5 weeks, finding out what is going on there, trying to get a better understanding of this family, and then we decided, yes, we are trying to build a school there. Another 4 weeks later, we finished all our work off back home. I canceled a couple of contracts I was on, and I went back to India. And we started to work with this family in Khajuraho to set up the school. Unfortunately, this cooperation didn't work out. After a couple of months, we quit, but we stayed because we liked this area in Madhya Pradesh. It's a beautiful state. It's, you know, you have this wilderness. It's rough. It's really very, very beautiful, and it brings you back to basics in life, which I believe many of us in the West or many of us living in the cities have lost. So somehow we decided to stay. I got a motorbike. I was traveling around in India. I think I've been to every state, all the way down to the south. I've been up in the mountains. But I always came back to this Madhya Pradesh. And then one day, someone else was asking me, why don't you want to work in our area? And I said, yeah. And then we were thinking what to do. And then I said, let's build a skate park. And the person I was talking to, he said, a skate park? What is this? So I showed him a video, and he liked it, and he said yes. So the decision was basically made within 5 minutes. And then I said, oh, Vinny, all you have to do is really secure the land where we are building the skate park on. And then he said, yes, I will do, because the land issue was the case which didn't work out with the first family. So he said he would secure the land. A guy showed up. He had three properties, and one of the properties he owned was in this village. So this is how I came to Janwar. I saw this village. I really somehow fell in love with this spot, and I decided, yeah, let it be in this village. And as I said earlier, I was inspired by the Skatistan, and this is where my working life comes in. I'm a network person, even though I'm not a digital native, but I really do believe in this new digital infrastructure for the better. So the concept, the skate park we have set up, and this is why the skate park doesn't have any fences. This is why the kids self-organize this space. It's really because it's built on the principle of network theory, that it is an open space that like-minded people can simply, you know, come plug in and play with us and drive with us this development or progress of the kids, of the villagers who are involved, that we can drive this together forward in a way which is not defined by us. I'm not the one telling the kids what to do or the villagers how to solve any kind of problem. I simply keep, you know, somehow disrupting them with the skate park or other kind of things, and then we look what they do with it. It's literally a change process. So how do you create change? You do create change if you disrupt an existing system. If everything is in balance, nothing will move. If you want to create change, things have to move. So you need a disruptor, and from there you only, you know, you can pretty much sit back, relax, and observe what is going on. And this is what I did in this village.
Great. Well, let me just pick up on a few things you've said there, and I'll throw a few thoughts out, and you can choose to answer them as you wish. You mentioned way back when you first went to Madhya Pradesh and stayed in this hotel, and you worked with originally the family that was behind that hotel, and you said you had the thought when they asked you to start the school, why me? Then eventually you canceled your contract, you went back, and then decided to go back to India and work to start the school. And I guess a couple of questions come up there. What was your answer to that question, why me, and why did you feel so compelled to change your life so dramatically to do this? That's one question. And then another question I'd love to follow up on is this notion that you just ended on about disrupting an existing system, and what motivated you to do that as someone from the outside?
Yeah. I think there is no precise answer to your first question, why me? The moment, and this is basically my entire life story, the moment I get interested in something, I think for myself, am I willing to do this, to take this chance or this opportunity, or am I not? And this idea of, well, the first idea of setting up a school in India, it simply caught my attention. So, and this was enough for me to follow up. And then, as I was saying, I sent this email to a friend of mine, and he's really a close friend. I've known him for many years, I think 30 years or so. And it also caught his attention. So this was enough for me to say, yeah, let's fight. And it turned out to be a very, very nice experience. And I wouldn't say that it has changed my life dramatically. There is a change in the living conditions. Yes, India is not as easygoing as a place like Heidelberg, where I'm born and where I come from. So India is much more of a hassle in many ways, but it also has to offer many things which we don't have at home. So it's actually a nice balance. And me, I've traveled, you know, most parts of my life. So I'm used to stay wherever I'm comfortable. So this is not that much of a change. Mm-hmm. Your second question? Sorry, I forgot.
No, that's great. You were talking about kind of how to the change process and how to create change, and you talked about constructing the existing system, and you create it. And I'm just curious, in your maybe focusing a little bit on your journey, how important has kind of outsiders coming in and disrupting, when I say outsiders, people maybe from not within a community coming in and disrupting an existing system, how has that manifested in your life? And then more specifically, why or what led you to be motivated by this notion of disrupting a system within a village in India?
How shall I say? I was always interested in, you know, to drive change for the better. And I was living in the mid-80s. I was living in the Northern Bay Area when we just got the first glimpses of the Internet. The Internet didn't have any pictures then. I got my first email account in 1987, and it was with The Well, which was really, or still is, the cult community on the web. And everyone there, it was probably a group of 100, 150 people in the early days, we knew that this new infrastructure somehow has the power to democratize and to give people a voice who usually don't have a voice. And this is important if, you know, if you want to change things. Let it be, I would say, without the Internet, the entire Arab Spring wouldn't have happened. Now you can say it's a good or bad thing, but this is another discussion where a lot of politics comes in. But basically, I would say Internet played a major role in connecting the people and to drive this change in the Arab world. Internet, if you look at certain industries, let it be mobile communication or look at Apple, at the big company, they were able to disrupt two industries, mobile industry and the music industry, because of, you know, understanding how digital is working. And they were using these infrastructures in a very smart way, and they became market leaders in markets they, you know, they've never been active before. So the Internet and its infrastructure is a very, very good enabler to, you know, to connect, and with these connections, finding out what the community is all about, and therefore you can easily learn how to improve, how to disrupt, and how, you know, to drive change. So this has been part of my work since 40 years now, almost 35 years. And for me, it's not a big difference if I go into a big corporate, let's say a bank or whatever, or into NATO in Brussels, close to where I sit now. If you want to drive change in such a corporate way, you need to disrupt. You know, you need to shake the system, a couple of people in there, in order to make the move. And the same is in the village. So the work itself hasn't changed much. It's just a different environment. And once you understand, when you ask yourself, if you're on the Internet, why do certain YouTube videos or whatever pop up and reach out to millions and millions of people? It's because they find resonance. And they find resonance in their communities, and this is something which, you know, cannot be bought. it cannot be bought with advertising dollars or with advertising euros. It's just what the community out there decides. And this is basically has changed the rules of how systems are working. Mm-hmm. Earlier, when an advertising dollar was much, much more worth in the age before the internet than it is today. You can't push in the internet. All you can do is pull. And what the advertising industry, what huge companies or even countries were doing, they were pushing with their financial power into markets to make people believe things. And this has completely changed with the internet.
Yeah, well, there's a lot we can talk about there, which I would, if we have some time, I'd love, and maybe with our listeners, to talk about in terms of the internet and how kind of, you know, especially in light of recent changes or recent developments about advertising in Russia and hacking and all these things. There's a lot we can talk about in terms of how the internet and the technology industry is evolving. But I want to go back to your story because I find it fascinating. What I find particularly interesting is that in addition to wanting to bring change to this village and disrupting, you were willing to disrupt your own life. And as you said, cancel contracts, go live in India, which is, you know, obviously a big change. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what you see in terms of the role of disrupting your own journey, you know, disrupting yourself and changing yourself internally and your situation with the kind of external change that you're disrupting and being a part of the shift in?
I don't think that I disrupted so much my own life. I was trying to say that, you know, this has been to live under various circumstances, to change from, you know, from one situation to another, I've been doing all my life. I think it's, how shall I say, I'm a curious person. I want to understand things, and I think the best way to understand situation, to understand issues, is if you go there and find out, you know, if you really experience your own, if you go to a country and, you know, if you experience it your own way, and then you can make your own opinion out of what you see. This has become really important for me since many years I don't believe the media anymore. I had a lot of questions, and this is why I actually started to travel and find out, you know, more about what is going on this world. And the only way to do so, I believe, is go out there to see, to live with people, to interact with them, to work with them on projects or whatever it is. And then, you know, you get a pretty good perspective, and you become capable of evaluating what is really going on there. So I was, you can say maybe it was some kind of dissatisfaction I felt in the Western world, that for so many questions I had, I didn't get answers which were satisfying. And then, you know, I went out, I started to travel, and I started to interact. The internet helped me a lot when it came up. And so it wasn't such a dramatic change now being in India. It's just, you know, another form for a short term in my life. I'm sure I'm not going to die in India, but if you ask me where will I go next, I don't know. It simply will somehow evolve out of what I've been doing my entire life.
So let me ask you what your view is about the intersection between change and disruption and change, and then continuity on the other hand. I know you've worked in the past in West Africa, working to empower rural communities to, you know, kind of avoid a paradigm of rich NGOs providing to them, but to try and be empowered themselves. Given that you know, say it's unlikely you're going to die in India, what do you see as, you know, the role of bringing about this external disruption and transformation with the kind of ongoing process and your engagement with that ongoing process of what the villagers will have to do going forward on their own?
Yeah. So basically the organization, if you want to call it like this, I'm working with, the people who are involved, we are very, very clear that we are there in this village to become obsolete. We have reached our goal if we are no longer needed. And this is literally what I mean. You know, I've been working with these kids and through the kids with the villagers over the last 2.5 years. What we have achieved through this skate park is that the discussion of caste, it's still there, but it has basically vanished. You see Adivasi, meaning tribal kids, sleeping, eating, playing with kids from various castes. This was unheard of, unimagined of before. Now it's simply happening. And the people who see it are actually happy because the kids are happy. All of a sudden through the skate park, we have the simple rule, no school, no skateboarding. It swamped the kids into the school. They had to get a new teacher. After 5 months, we were there. So it helped in this way. Since we got some nice media awareness, a lot of people are traveling to this village. We have established homestays. It's actually very cheap to stay there. It's like $3 a night. But this is a lot of money for the people. So we have 5 or 6 homestays, and this drives a little bit economic change in the village as well, since now a couple of parents can pay for their, and they do this mainly for girls, that they can go to a school, because the school in our village ends at grade 8. So this is all, these are all things which are happening, and our goal is really that these kids, and this is where self-organization plays a very crucial part, that the kids take responsibility, ownership of what we are doing. And the more they understand these principles, the more they will be capable of doing it in their own way. And I'm very happy to leave this village in a couple of years, you know, and then the kids, or maybe then the young women and men will go on their own and keep, you know, keep this village going. So we are really there to become obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I'm looking very much relaxed that I do not have to die in India.
Yeah, that's great. So just a very quick question. How much time do you spend in Madhya Pradesh now over the course of a given year? And how do you communicate with the local population?
I mean, I lived there. So this year I wasn't, because I was in between very sick. But usually I'm there the entire year. I probably leave for a couple of weeks. I go back home 3-4 weeks. I travel a bit in India, but most of the time I'm there. The communication is actually a very funny thing. I do not speak Hindi, and I also don't want to really learn it, because it's a natural barrier between me and especially the elder ones in the village. This way I really avoid to get involved in every tiny little kind of thing they would come up. For example, that they ask me to take one of their kids to hospital because they are sick. Since I cannot, you know, I cannot provide help only to one family. If I would do such a thing, I would have to do it for the entire village. And this is impossible because I don't have the financial power to do so. So not speaking the language helps that people don't come with these things. The kids slowly learn English. We are capable of getting things done. They understand when I talk to them, not very complicated things, but they do understand. I also get a little Hindi, so it's a mix between English and Hindi. And, of course, I do have a colleague, Manan. He is from Delhi. He's with me since over a year now. And on more complicated issues, he will simply translate.
Mm-hmm. And I know you previously worked in West Africa. Can you tell us a little bit about how long you worked there and, you know, what kind of relationships are in the communities that you worked in and whether those are ongoing?
Yeah, actually, the relationship to West Africa, and it's mainly Benin. It's a very, very small country bordering Nigeria, Togo, Ghana. And this was more of a family-related thing, since the father of my son, he came from Benin. So we went there when my son was like 8, 9 years old. This is now almost 20 years back. Mm-hmm. We went to visit the family, and we drove around in Benin, and we ended up in the northern part of the country in a small village, which was actually run by women, and it was an NGO, an African NGO, by five of these local women in Alejo, and they really impressed me, these ladies. I mean, they were real African mamas, you know, and they were really, really strong. And the way they were handling these efforts in the village was really amazing. So I kept coming back there and trying to support them with computers and internet infrastructure and you know, mental support, also support in a way that I would stay for small projects for at least 3 years, and then I wasn't capable of following up for 5 or 6 years, and now it's basically a family relationship thing, but no longer I'm actually involved in work there.
Okay.
But the problems you see in these African villages are basically the same than you will see in India or China in the villages. Or
and based on your experience in Africa, did you find that when you that you know had to step away inevitably that the villagers were able to carry on some of the projects on their own in a sustained way?
They do. I mean, this. The computer center we have established, it's still up and running. It's become bigger. Yes, these things are going, but you always do need, and this is, I would say, what I have learned over the years. You know, if you come in, especially as a foreigner, if you don't have the acceptance within the community, everything you do will sooner or later fail. So it's not so much the question of having money and getting things done. It's much, much more the question of how you convince or how you interact with these people that they do take responsibility and ownership of whatever they want to happen. And these things will last. And this is what I meanwhile believe what is completely wrong with all our development aid models we are working on. We always think that we have to go somewhere and, you know, implement solutions which most of the time are designed on some desk in some big town, maybe in Delhi or even in the West. And then you come, you go into these villages, and you try to implement what you think is of great help for these people. this is not working like this. And this is why so many programs, especially these predefined programs who have predefined outcomes, are not working. And when the people are leaving, then 2 or 3 years later, everything is rotten. So I mean, in India, I see so many projects which are heavily funded by our German government or British Council or whatever. You mean it? I mean, billions and billions of dollars are spent every year. And this we've been doing since decades, right? And still, more two-thirds of the population in India are living below the poverty line. Mm-hmm. So it's a legitimate question to ask, why is this so? And I think one of, or the most important answer to this, it's because the system is wrong. The system, most of these development agencies are working, this system is rotten. This needs to be renewed. Yeah, it needs to be renewed in a way, as I was trying to say earlier. We are built to become obsolete. But which NGO wants to become obsolete?
Right.
They all are there because they have a pretty comfortable life. You know, they earn double the money they usually get because they are stationed out of the country, and they have a pretty comfortable life. They do, most of them do not really understand what it means to live in a village like Chanbar. I'm not saying these are bad people, but what I'm saying is there was a huge lack of the problems of these people in these villages for whom they design solutions for. So if you don't integrate them in the creation of the solution, you will never ever have acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of your project, and maybe we could just think about just like what would be failure. Let's say you leave in a few years and the skate park continues for a couple of years, people maintain it, some of the rules stay the same. Over time, some of those rules start slipping away, maybe certain local people, men, start controlling it. What would be failure in your mind, from your perspective, of your legacy of the skate park?
You see, the skate park is not the most important thing. The skate park is the trigger for change. So it's what we've been achieving over the last 2.5 years, and this is the most astonishing thing, is that there is a change in the mindset of the people. And this is what you need. You know, you can do many, many things, but if people don't change in their mindset, don't understand why learning can be good, or why it is why, you know, being clean is better than, you know, remaining dirty. If they don't really feel this with their own hands in their own environment, they will never ever understand. So failure for us would be that we are still necessary, let's say, in 10 years. Then we have failed.
Yeah, so just to take your example, people, and I love your rule that you can't, you know, go to the, or you get more opportunities to go to the skate park if you've gone to school. And you said, you know, fail.
No, the other way around. Excuse me. It's the other way around.
They go to school, they're allowed more access to the skate park.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you said there's a change in the mindset of the people, that school is good and things like that. I guess I say this because I've been involved in some development efforts in India, and the question is just, you know, the after a time, let's say the skate park shifts after you leave, and they no longer have that rule. And then people suddenly going to school longer. I guess I'm thinking if it's a transactional view that they have, that if I go to school longer, I will get this reward. And if the reward is no longer there, have you really shifted the consciousness? Or, you know, it's not, I guess I'm wondering, is it an intrinsic change?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. No. It's it's much, much more than the skate park. So what happened since the skate park is there? As I said, please only understand it as a trigger for change. It's nothing more, nothing less. It has disrupted the village. And this is why certain kids and then families have started to move. All of a sudden, we find out that some of the kids are interested in the arts. Some of the kids really love sports. Other kids love to build stuff. All of them are somehow interested in farming because they all are working in the fields. None of these things are happening at the school. So what happened already after 2.5 years is that all of us, and this is why I'm talking about co-creation and collaboration, because the kids were interested in the arts, because the kids are interested in doing better farming or in making spots or in building things, we have designed with the kids together what we call learning labs. These learning labs, they can last for 2 hours, they can last for 2 weeks, depending on what it is, where the kids can work, and only those kids who are interested. If it's only one, fine, we'll do it for one. They can work on a specific topic they are interested in addition to school. So what we basically do, we have defined 4 areas so far. This is sports, this is the arts including everything, music, dance, sculpture, everything. Then we have a maker lab and we have farming. These are the 4 additional fields in addition to the schools where kids are interested in, where we are doing learning camps, where they become better, and we don't have to, you know, to define a new curriculum or so on. Excuse me. Because we stay with the government school, but we add on these learning labs. At the same time, we work together with these government schools and we do teacher training programs. Other people are coming in and they are not paid by us. They come because they love the project. And they help these teachers to become aware of better ways of teaching. And we have volunteers coming in who are running theater workshops, you know, who are interacting with the teachers and the children on, you know, maybe doing math for 2 weeks in English. All these kind of things are happening. And they are happening because we have set up this concept as open. As I said, everyone who wants can simply plug in. And plugging in doesn't mean that we pay them. It does mean that we share common values to drive somehow this change onwards. And this will continue. And I mean, it's already happening without me or us being there. And therefore, I'm quite positive that it will stay, because somehow the people, you know, they see and they have learned that if they do something, then other things will happen. And this is for villagers in such a remote area in India. It's for the very first time that they experience that someone is coming and staying with them, coming back, without asking for anything back. We are just there and drive things forward. And these people, they do understand this and they are very, very much engaged.
That's remarkable. It's beautiful.
And I think Development Aid, those people who are responsible for this, they would take the people they work for much, much more serious, and if they would look at them as equal partners in this process, I'm very sure we can achieve much, much more than we ever have.
I There's I want to ask a bunch of questions about what takes a girl from Germany like you to the Bay Area to participate in this online community, The Well, which was kind of a spiritual community. What was that initial journey like, and then how you got involved later in the development field? But Raul, I don't know if you want to jump in at this point.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to remind folks that they can also ask a question for Ulrika if they're interested. So if you have a question and you are dialed into the call, you can press *6 to get in the queue. Or if you're listening remotely through the webcast, you can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. And I know Preetha has a bunch of questions. I do too. And so we're delighted to continue along those paths, but just wanted to remind folks that they do have an opportunity to share their own question as well. Go ahead, Preetha.
Yeah, great, Ulrika. I was just asking about your personal journey.
So I was studying economics, and when I finished my studies, I just felt like taking a year off, and I went to America. The sister of my father, she was still living in New York, so I went to see her, and from there I started traveling. So I ended up somehow in San Francisco. I got married there, so I stayed a couple of years longer. Unfortunately, my husband died kind of early. But this was in the mid-80s when this entire internet community was starting to evolve. And it was simply for my life now, looking back, I was at the right time, at the right place. And having met all these people in the mid-80s, like Howard Rheingold, Stuart Brand, they all were around. And I'm still in contact with them. So it was simply, again, it was coincidence. And it was luck that I was there and got the opportunity. And I simply taken the chance.
That's fabulous. You also talked about, we started talking a little bit about the internet, and there's so much we could go into there, which I'll refrain from at the moment. But the one question I did have for you in your time in rural India, there's such a proliferation of Facebook and WhatsApp in India generally, but even starting to reach rural India. And I'm wondering what you're seeing there and what in terms of both reach and potential impact.
Yeah, so in the village we are working, we do not even have network coverage. So we have to drive 5 kilometers to make a phone call. So leave alone having internet connectivity. Also, you have to understand that these people, as I was saying earlier, they live below the poverty line. Whenever they get a few Indian rupees, their highest priority will not be to buy airtime or data time. So even the most ambitious programs Modi is setting up for Digital India are more or less a joke. It's like, I can speak for our area, and I know it from many others, the main broadband line ends like 4 or 5 kilometers away from the village. They do not go the last mile down. We are just trying to get internet into our village, but it's an investment of at least 12 to 15,000 US dollars to get this to get signal into the village. And the government does expect that if we want internet, that we pay for this. So in the rural areas, when we talk about Facebook, Google, all these kind of things, they are simply unknown. when you go away in the next bigger city, for example, in our case, it's Panna, it's like 7-8 kilometers away. Usually the villagers don't go that far. So Facebook is a huge topic, but it's very superficial. When I talk about internet, I rarely talk about these applications. For me, internet is this underlying infrastructure. It's really the tool to connect, to collaborate at zero costs, and simply to, you know, to reach out to people whom earlier you weren't capable of doing so. So for me, internet is the infrastructure we now have to really do democracy. This is where we all started out in the 80s. This was the big dream. Many things since then happened. There is a huge movement from governments, from big companies to commercialize this internet, and again take it away from the people on the ground. But the model itself, this is what I always say. Janwa Castle, this is the name of our skate park, is actually all about. It's built on a network structure. And this is what I mean when I say internet. And this is what I hope when I see, now I'm currently traveling with three of these kids through Europe. I think even without discussing all these things, they do understand a lot, and the way they act here, the way they behave, it's very, very open and very it's really a thing built on trust, and this is what we need, I believe, in this world.
I couldn't agree more, Ulrika. I just wanted to remind folks on the call, who have a question, press star 6 if they've got one. And I actually have some questions for you as well, which I'll ask in, while we're waiting for folks to chime in. So, Ulrika, I just love the sort of model of social change that you are espousing. To me, it sounds a little bit like using disruption almost as a Trojan horse, and then using that Trojan horse to kind of get into people's hearts and plant seeds for a different possibility, and nurture those seeds just long enough to know that there might be a fruit tree on the other end, but then to really kind of step away before there ever really is a tree. Once someone else has decided to continue to nurture that tree. And I just think that model that you're talking about is so revolutionary, as you point out, with regard to the way that other traditional organizations and NGOs have looked at social change. I know that you're early in your experiment, but I'm curious about whether you've seen other more traditional NGOs or government agencies sort of take notice of this budding experiment that's going on in Nunwar.
They do take notice, I can tell you this. Like every day I at least get one email or one message, can we have a skate park in our village? It's many of them are not really serious. I currently speak at least with 10 different organizations or institutions in India, where they slowly have understood that it's not only about building a skate park, but that the underlying structure, this open sandbox, is actually the most important thing to drive this change. They are very serious, and I'm very, very positive that within the next year, we will see in wool areas, 2, 3, 4 more skate parks. And I'm also very positive if these people succeed in understanding the concept in a better way, then change will happen there as well. Yes, you are right. We are not that far down the road. It is still, or it was an experiment, but what we see is that it's working out really well. And, you know, I've been also working with companies over the time of 10 years or so. And when you keep disrupting and when more and more people adapt to this in companies, let it be employees, then the process continues without yourself who needs to disrupt constantly. Because then you have like 10 others all of a sudden in a company, or in our case in a village, who will play this role as disruptor. Sure. And then, yeah. It's actually simple, but it has a lot to do with, you know, giving up power and letting things go. This system is not built on hierarchy. It's not built on control. Whatever, when we disrupt, we never define an outcome, meaning we don't have a very, very specific goal in things we do, but we do have a very, very clear vision. We want to make this life more comfortable for these people there. We want them, you know, to become more self-confident. All these things we have, but for a very specific issue, let's take this trip through Europe now, we don't have a defined outcome. We don't have a defined goal. Because each of these three kids will have, you know, will experience and do it in its very own way. So there is nothing for us to predefine, because whatever they will do with it will be the right thing for them. And this is when I look at the conversations we are currently having with other places who want to set up these skate parks. This is the most challenging thing for an organization who wants to run such a project. They usually want to control, they usually define outcomes, you know, 5% economic growth or 20 people more at school, something like this. We don't have all this. We say, you know, we look what the kids, what the villagers do with it, and then we help them to achieve their own individual learning path. And that's a completely different approach.
Absolutely. I know that Britak has another question, and I also wanted to allow space for that, for to ask that, and also wanted to remind folks to press *6 if they've got a question, or email us at ask@servicespace.org. Go ahead, Britak.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I just, I love also, like Arul, I love the vision of social change that you've outlined, and I wanted to just, and you also talked about the Arab Spring and disruption and the role of the internet. You know, there's one thing about disruption, and like in the Arab Spring, I think we saw that. You see disruption, and then you see, you know, how the rebuilding happens after the disruption. And in that case, you know, there was the Muslim Brotherhood. The tools that disrupt often are not the tools that can allow for...
Please. I'm very sorry, especially with the Muslim Brotherhood. I think what happened in the Arab Spring is that it's a highly, highly political issue. There are many, many, many interests involved. And when you specifically point out about the Muslim Brotherhood, I think you also need to say, and the same thing holds true not only for Egypt but for Tunisia as well, they had a similar organization which is called Ennahda, or which was called Ennahda, and I think still is. They are still a part of the government in Tunisia. So ENADA, as well as the Muslim Brotherhood, were the only organizations during the dictatorships which really went into the last parts of the countries, in the tiny little villages. There have been organizations which provided food, education, medical services in the remote areas of these countries. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they did a good job, I'm not saying they did a bad job, but ENADA in Tunisia and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, they did exactly this. So yeah, what happened when the National Council was founded, which was actually only there to write a new constitution, but what happened through especially the engagement of the United States and the Western world, that these national councils almost became new governments. They were never ever to be there to become government. But when they were formed, of course, these two organizations won the majority of the seats, because those were the only ones who had coverage all over the country.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get into a political discussion about the
Arab Spring. I mean, if you only put it out like this, I'm sorry.
I didn't finish what I was saying about that. But in any event, I think you jumped in before I finished my comment there. But what I was trying to say, the bigger question I was trying to ask you is, as you're building this field, as you said, you want to make yourself obsolete. That's the idea of social change. And eventually local people will take over the change process in whatever form is right for them. And with the skateboard park being the trigger. The question I have for you is, how will you know that there's sufficiency in the field that you're cultivating locally that you will feel comfortable walking away? What are you looking for in terms of that? What will you be looking for in making that determination of when you can walk away or when you're comfortable walking away?
If you ask me now, I cannot answer. I think this day will come when I feel, you know, it's done. Then I will walk away. I'm sure this time will come. If you ask me now when it is, I don't know. And I don't have a specific kind of criteria, you know, which I say this needs to be done to do so. Usually when you look at companies, you can say when 5 to 10% of the employees have really started moving over a longer time, a period of time, let's say 2 or 3 years, then the process within will continue. So I can't tell you, but as I said, I don't have these criteria. I would say, you know, if different is a distance, it's done. I will walk away. I don't know yet.
Sure. I have a slightly different form of that question or different implication, Ulrika. You know, there's this sort of Old Testament story of the Jews casting off the life of bondage in Egypt and going into exile and then sort of arriving at the Promised Land, but then ultimately sort of recreating life as under Pharaoh, under the Promised Land, which didn't represent the spirit of exile and freedom in the first place. So just sort of taking the idea that Greta expressed further, you know, would you, let's say that the model of change that the villagers went through arrived them back at just a new form of stratification and separation after you had walked away, would that form of their own self-governance still feel like a success for you, or would that, because it was driven by their own autonomy, or would it feel like a failure because it had replicated the conditions that they were in before under a new name, a new label?
Yeah. First of all, I would say there is nothing as a promised land, because we do not promise. There are no promises made. Everything we do is initiated by the villagers. So we don't say, you know, or we don't define anything like a promised land or promised change. We simply don't do this. If the village would fall back, as you said, into separation or whatever again, I would say, I would, if I look at the process, it depends on the process, how this would happen. This would define if I would call it a failure or not. For example, if a country like Syria is disrupted by a war like this, and the and the Syrian people now, even 5-6 years later, say we are perfectly fine with Assad, I would say, you know, probably most of the West would call it a failure. If you ask the Syrian people, they probably say it's fine. So it really depends on what the people want. So if the process, let's say in 10 years, a caste would enter again into this village, if this is something they people really want to, and they would come to this solution in a way of co-creation and collaboration, it's perfectly fine for me. Sure. If it would be a driven force from outside, you know, who were trying to split the villagers because somehow they are now more unified than they used to be before, yeah, then I would call it a failure. You understand what I mean?
I think so.
Yeah.
We have a question that came in online from Bubby in California. She says, thank you for your work in the world, Ulrika. I was curious to know where you draw inspiration from. Are there particular people, models, or initiatives that have encouraged you on your own path?
Yeah, I certainly had during the last, 40 years, I had a couple of role models of people I worked with over a longer period of time, and they certainly inspired me. They helped me somehow to understand better what I'm doing. There are probably a handful of people, who played an important role in my life, and I think, they were really important, and without them, I probably would have walked down a very, very different path.
Are there any of these figures that are sort of well known, or is there a common thread amongst them
I think the common thread is certainly that they all were somehow involved in network theory, in internet. I mean, probably one of them, you know, it's Joey Ito from the MIT Media Lab. We've talking over a longer period of time together. I've done some with the MIT here in India as well. There is another guy, a professor in Germany, Peter Kruse, with whom I've been working over the last 10, 12 years, and he was certainly the one who understood network theory pretty well. It made a lot of sense to me what he was saying, so it really helped me to understand in a more theoretical way what I'm actually doing in reality, you know, on the ground. So,
That's fascinating. You know, given that, you know, all of you were sort of early members of the well and perhaps had this visceral and perhaps very natural understanding of network theory and its possibilities, I'm curious if that broader community from the kind of mid-80s days of the well has also kind of stayed in contact with each other broadly and seeded different sorts of experiments of applying these concepts for social change in various ways, like you've done with Skatistan. Do you find that that group is kind of continues to be in solidarity around the possibility of what this theory can do in the world?
I think so. Many of them have. Like, if you take Howard Rheingold as an example, he's been working together with Stanford universities, experimenting on new ways of learning. There is John Barlow. He was also a founding member of the Well and earlier the Whole Earth Catalog. He's been founding member of the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who has been really working hard to keep the internet, you know, free and open. Stuart Brand, certainly with the Long Now Foundation, they do a lot of work how to drive change, and, you know, they connect people on a very, very high level. I would say all these people who were originally involved and were on fire with this, what the internet had to offer, they are all still working in these fields. And they use this network structure, the network intelligence, in various ways. And they work in various industries. And yeah, I actually, if I look back, I can't think of one who has somehow left the community.
That's interesting. Rika, how do you think about the contrast between loose ties and deep ties in network theory, and that's the sort of capacity to create change across both of those types of ties?
I didn't understand. Your voice was breaking. Sorry. Can you please repeat?
Oh, I was asking about how you think about loose ties versus deep ties in network theory. You know, the idea of relationships that are sort of superficial versus relationships that are sort of deep and enduring and lasting in the capacity to create social change.
I'm not so sure if I would differentiate between these two. Usually, the people I work with, we share common values, we share common principles, so to speak, and this you only can do when you have some deep kind of relationship. If there is some superficial stuff like putting out some nice photos on Facebook and sending a like, this has nothing to do with social change, and it also has nothing to do with relationship. You know, I think at the end of the day, there are not too many where you really, let it be online or in real life, where you have a deep relationship with, where you have these really strong ties. The internet, yes, makes it easier to have these strong ties all over the globe, and I'm very happy to have a network wherever I go. There are people whom I can 100% trust and rely on. In this way, the internet does help. But with superficial or loose ties, I do not deal. I simply do not deal with.
That makes a lot of sense. Ulrika, it's my privilege as the host of the call to ask you our final question of our discussion, which is, how can we as the broader service space community support the work that you're doing in the world?
I think, and this is something which I realized really over the last 2.5 years, it's a very easy thing, but it's sometimes very, very hard to do. Simply walk your talk. start by walking your talk. Whatever you say, you better should do. If you don't do, then, you know, things won't happen. So if everyone would simply start walking their own talk, I think change would will happen very quickly in many, many areas.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Ulrika, for joining us. We like to actually end our calls with a minute of silence, and this time it's a minute of silence for in gratitude for the time you've taken to share with us and for all of the causes and conditions and volunteers behind the scenes who are helping and have helped to make this space possible. And after the call, I will actually unmute folks so that you can share the gratitude. But for now, we will just take 1 minute of silence. Thank you. I have unmuted everyone on the call, and what we will do is just on the count of three, we'll just say thank you, Ulrika, and as an expression of our gratitude. So here we go. One, two, three.
Thank you, Ulrika. Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.